paused by the writing desk. He snatched the unfinished letter from under the folio and slid it into a sleeve, along with a sharpened pencil. Ink was more elegant and wouldn't smudge. Still, Sarah wouldn't give a damn, so long as the letter got there and contained the latest news.
"Come on,"
Uthan urged, impatiently, when Lark reemerged.
"Hop aboard, and let's hoof it."
The Grey Kellen scientist dipped one end of his shell to the ground. This time, Harulan groaned annoyance. Sure, kids did it all the time, but it wasn't dignified for an adult Grey, especially one with ancestry like Othan's, to go around carrying a human on his back. Still, they would move faster now, toward the meadow of concealed aliens, hurrying to see the wonder that had emerged. If anything, Ling understated when she called them beautiful. Lark had never envisioned anything quite like them, not when leafing through ancient picture books or reading pre-contact works of space fiction, not even in his dreams. In the vernacular of Jijo's exiled tribes, it was common to call all galactics star gods. Yet here, strolling a forest clearing, were beings that seemed all but literally worthy of the name. So exquisite were they to behold. Lark could stand it only for moments at a stretch, then he had to look away, lest his eyes fill with tears and his chest begin to ache. Ling and the other forayer humans formed a guard of honor around their noble patrons, while vigilant robots hovered. Occasionally, one of the tall, stoop-shouldered Rothan crooked a finger, beckoning Ron or Besh to lean upward and explain something, like children called on to recite, gesturing at a nearby tree, one of the tent pavilions, a herd of spline beasts, or a shy infant Gekek. Crowds gathered. Proctors of gathering, armed with red-dyed sticks, kept people from pressing too close, but there seemed small likelihood of a shameful outburst. Hardly anyone even whispered, so thick was the atmosphere of awe. The effect seemed greatest on the humans present, most of whom stared with hushed wonderment and bewildered familiarity. Rothan were humanoid to an uncanny degree, with high, noble foreheads, wide, sympathetic eyes, eloquent noses, and droopy, soft-fringed eyebrows that seemed to purse with sincere, attentive interest in anyone or everything they encountered. Nor were these parallels coincidental, Lark supposed. Physical and emotional affinities would have been cultivated during the long process of uplift, tens of thousands of years ago, when Rothan experts tinkered and modified a tribe of graceless but promising apes back on Pliocene Earth, altering them gradually into beings almost ready for the stars. That assumed these creatures really were humanity's long-hidden patrons, as Ling claimed. Lark tried to retain an attitude of cautious neutrality, but found it hard in the face of such evidence. How could this race be any other than humankind's lost patrons? When the two august visitors were introduced to the assembled high sages, Lark drew comfort from the serene expressions of Vubbin, Fahundau, and others, none of whom wore rauk for the occasion. Even Lester Campbell remained composed, at least on the outside, when presented to Roken and Ropol, whose names Ron pronounced for all to hear. By human standards, Roken appeared to be male, and though Lark tried not to be overly influenced by analogies, the more delicate-featured Ropol struck him as possibly female. The crowd murmured when the two smiled, revealing small white teeth, conveying apparent pleasure at the meeting. Ropol's grin creased in ways that might even be called dimples. The word merry tempted Lark as a way to describe the slider Rothan's cheerful mien. It wouldn't be hard to like a face like that, so warm, open, and filled with understanding. It makes sense, Lark thought. If the Rothan really are our patrons, wouldn't they have ingrained us with similar esteem patterns? Nor were Earthlings alone affected. After all, the six races had a lot of experience with each other. You didn't have to be a Kewan to sense the charisma of a stately queen. So why shouldn't an Urz or Hoon or Gekek sense this potent humanoid magnetism? Even without Rauk, most of the non-humans present seemed caught up in the prevailing mood. Hope. Lark recalled Ling's assurance that the Forayer mission would succeed without incident, and Jijo's commons needn't be changed in any but positive ways. It will all work out, she had said. Ling had also told him the Rothan were special beings, even among high galactic clans. Operating in deliberate obscurity, they had quietly arranged for old Earth to lie fallow, off the colonization lists, for half a billion years, an accomplishment with implications Lark found hard to imagine. Needing no fleets or weapons, the Rothan were influential, mystical, mysterious, in many ways godlike, even compared with those beings whose vast armadas thundered across the five galaxies. No wonder Ling and her peers thought themselves above so-called laws of migration and uplift, as they sifted Jijo's biosphere for some worthy species to adopt. No wonder she seemed fearless over the possibility of being caught. The newly cave-fledged Rauk also appeared dazzled ever since the tall pair emerged from the buried research station. The one on Lark's brow trembled, casting splashy aurei around the two Rothan till he finally had to peel it back. Lark tried to wrest control over his thoughts, reclaiming a thread of skepticism. It may be that all advanced races learn to do what the Rothan are doing now, impressing those beneath them on the ladder of status. Perhaps we're all extra susceptible on account of being primitives, having no other experience with galactics. But skepticism was slippery as the Rothan emissaries conversed with the sages in voices that seemed warm, compassionate. A robot amplified the discourse for all to hear. We too now express grateful and respectful honors for your hospitality, Roken said in a very prim, grammatically perfect Gal 6. Furthermore, we now express regret for any anxiety our presence may have generated among your noble commons, Ropol added. Only of late have we come to realize the depth of your unease. Overcoming our natural reticence, our shyness, if you will, we now emerge to soothe your quite unwarranted fears. Again, whispers of tentative hope from the crowd. Not an easy emotion for Jijoan exiles. Roken spoke again. Now we express joy and appreciation to have been invited to attend your sacred rites. One of us shall accompany you on this eve to witness the wonderment inherent in, and remarkably expressed by, your renowned and holy egg. Meanwhile, Ropole continued, the other of us shall withdraw to contemplate how best to reward your commons for your pains, your worries, and your hard sequestered lives. Ropole appeared to muse on the problem for a moment, choosing her words. Some gift we foresee, some benefaction to help you through the ages ahead, as each of your co-joined races seeks salvation down the long, courageous path known as Return to Innocence. A murmur coursed the ranks of onlookers, pleasure at this surprising news. Now each of the sages took turns making a welcoming speech, starting with Vubbin, whose aged wheels squeaked as he rolled forward to recite from one of the oldest scrolls, something apropos about the ineffable nature of mercy, which drifts upward from the ground when least expected, a grace that cannot be earned or even merited, only lovingly accepted when it comes. Lark led the neophyte Rauk slip back over his eyes. The Rothen pair remained immersed in a nimbus of confused colors, so while Vubbin droned on, he turned and scanned the assembled onlookers. Of course, Rauk offered no magic window to the soul. Mostly they helped make up for the fact that each race came equipped with brain tissue specifically adapted for reading emotional cues from its own kind. Rauk were most effective when facing another Rauk-equipped being, especially if the two symbionts first exchanged empathy hormones. Is that why the sages aren't wearing theirs now? In order to protect secret thoughts? From the throng, he picked up ripples of fragile optimism and mystical wonder, cresting here and there with spume-like waves of near-religious fervor. There were other colors, however, from several dozen Kellens, Hoon, Urs, and men, proctors and militia guards. There flowed cooler shades of duty, refusal to be distracted by anything short of a major earthquake. Another glittering twinkle Lark quickly recognized as a different kind of duty, more complex, focused, and vain. It accompanied a brief reflection off a glass lens. Bloor and his comrades at work, Lark guessed. Busy recording the moment. Lark's symbiont was working better now. In fact, despite its lack of training, it might never again be quite this sensitive. At this moment, almost every Rauk in the valley was the same age, fresh from caves where they had lately mingled in great piles, sharing unity enzymes. Each would be acutely aware of the others at longer than normal range. I should warn Bloor. His people shouldn't wear Rauk. If it lets me spot them, it might help robots, too. Another swirl caught his eye, flashing bitterly from the far end of the glade, standing out from the prevailing mood like a fire burning on an ice field. There was no mistaking a flare of acrid hate. Finally, he made out a shaggy, snake-like neck rising from the profile of a small centaur. Rauk mediated colors like a globe of distilled loathing obscured the head itself. The wearer of that distant, powerful symbiont suddenly seemed to notice Lark's focused regard. Shifting her attention from aliens to sages, she turned to face Lark directly. Across a crowd of shifting, sighing citizens, they watched each other's colors. Then, in unison, each pulled back their Rauk. In clear light, Lark met her unblinking stare. the Irish leader of the Zealot cause. A rebel whose malice toward invaders was stronger than Lark had realized. With those three fierce eyes turned his way, Lark needed no symbiont to translate the Zealot's feelings toward him. Under the late afternoon sun, her neck twisted, and she snarled an Irish smile of pure, disdainful contempt. The pilgrimage commenced at dusk, with long forest shadows pointing toward a hidden mountain pass. 12 twelves of chosen citizens represented all the commons, along with 2 star humans, 4 robots, and 1 tall ancient being whose shambling gait hinted great strength under glossy white robes. Judging by his so-human-like smile, Roken seemed to find delight in countless things, especially the rhythmic chanting, a blending of vocal contributions from all races, as the assembly set out past steaming vents and sheer clefts, weaving its slow way toward the hidden oval valley of the egg. The Rothen's long-fingered hands stroked slim-boled whelpel trees, whose swaying resonated with emanations from that secret veil. Most humans would hear nothing till they got much closer. In Lark's heart, dark feelings churned. Nor was he alone. Many, especially those farthest from Roken's cheerful charisma, still felt uneasy about guiding strangers to this sacred place. The procession marched, rolled, and slithered, wending higher into the hills. Soon the heavens glittered with formations of sparkling lights, brittle bright clusters and nebulae divided by the dark stripe of the galactic disk. If anything, the sight reinforced the starkly uneven order of life, for tonight's guests would shortly cross these starscapes, whether they departed in peace or betrayal. To them, Jijo would become another quaint, savage, perhaps mildly interesting spot they had visited once in long, deified lives. The last time Lark came up this way, so earnest about his self-appointed mission to save Jijo from invaders like himself, no one had any thought of starships cruising Jijo's sky. Yet they were already up there, preparing to land. What is more frightening? The danger you already dread, or the trick the universe hasn't pulled on you yet? The one to make all prior concerns seem moot. Lark hoped none of this gloom carried into his letter to Sarah, which he had finished in a hurried pencil scrawl by the headwaters of the Beaver after the Rothen emerged. The kayak pilot added Lark's note to a heavy bundle from Bloor, then set off in a flash of oars, speeding down the first set of spuming rapids in a pell-mell rush toward Byblos, 2 days' hard rowing away. On his way back to rendezvous with the other heretics, he had stopped to watch the alien aircraft glide out of its dark tunnel like a wraith, rising on whispering engines. Lark glimpsed a small human silhouette, hands and face pressed against an oval window, drinking in the view. The figure looked familiar. But before he could raise his pocket ocular, the machine sped away eastward toward a cleft where the largest moon was rising above the Rimmer Range. Now, as the evening procession entered a final twisty canyon leading to the egg, Lark tried putting temporal concerns aside, preparing for communion. "It may be my last chance," he thought, hoping this time he might fully take part in the wholeness others reported when the egg shared its full bounty of love. Drawing his right arm inside his sleeve, he grasped the rocky flake, despite its growing heat. A passage from the Scroll of Exile came to mind, an Anglic version, modified for Earthlings by one of the first human sages. We drift, rudderless, down the stream of time, betrayed by our ancestors who left us here, blind to much that was hard learnt by other ages, fearful of light and the law, but above all, anxious in our hearts that there might be no God, no Father, no heavenly succor, or else that we are already lost to him, to fate, to destiny. Where shall we turn in banished agony with our tabernacle lost and faith weighed down by perfidy? What solace comes to creatures lost in time? One source of renewal never fails. With rhythms long, its means are fire and rain, ice and time. Its names are myriad. To poor exiles, it is home. Gijo. The passage ended on a strange note of combined reverence and defiance. If God still wants us, let him find us here. Till then, we grow part of this, our adopted world, not to hinder, but to serve her cyclic life, to sprout humble goodness out of the foul seed of crime. Not long after, that scroll gained acceptance in the human sept. One winter's day, ground tremors shook the slope. Trees toppled, dams burst, and a terrible wind blew. Panic swept from mountains to sea amid reports that Judgment Day had come. Instead, bursting through a cloud of sparkling dust, the egg appeared. A gift out of Gijo's heart. A gift which must be shared tonight with aliens. What if they achieved what he had always failed? Or worse, what if they reacted with derisive laughter, declaring that the egg was a simple thing that only yokels would take seriously, like fabled Earth natives worshipping a music box they found on the shore? Lark struggled to push out petty thoughts, to tune himself with the basso rumble of the hoon, the Kewan's calliope piping, the twanging spokes of the gekeks, and all the other contributions to a rising song of union. He let it take over the measured pace of his breathing, while warmth from the stone fragment seemed to swell up his hand and arm, then across his chest, spreading relaxed detachment. Close, he thought. A tracery of soft patterns began taking shape in his mind, a web-like meshing of vague spirals made up partly of images, partly of sound. It's almost as if something is trying to... Is this not exciting? A voice broke in from Lark's right, splitting his concentration into broken shards. I believe I can feel something now. It's quite unlike any psi phenomenon I have experienced. The motif is highly unusual. Ignore her, Lark thought, clinging to the patterns. Maybe she'll go away. But Ling kept talking, sending words clattering up avenues that could not help hearing them. The harder he tried holding on, the quicker detachment slipped away. Lark's hand now clenched a clammy ball of rock and twine, warm with his body heat alone. He let go in disgust. We picked up some tremors on instruments several days ago. The cycles have been rising in strength and complexity for some time. Ling seemed blithely unaware of having done anything wrong. That, in turn, made Lark's simmering resentment seem both petty and futile. Anyway, her beauty by moonlight was even more unnerving than usual, cutting through his anger to a vulnerable loneliness within. Lark sighed. "Aren't you supposed to be guarding your boss?"
"Robots do the real guarding, as if we have anything to fear. Roken gave Ron and me permission to look around while he talks to your sages, preparing them for what's about to happen."
Lark stopped so suddenly, the next pilgrim in line had to stumble to avoid him. He took Ling's elbow. "What are you talking about? What's about to happen?" Ling's smile carried a touch of the old sardonicism.
"You mean you haven't guessed by now? Oh, Lark, think about the coincidences. For 2,000 years, Sooners of various races lived on this world, squabbling and slowly devolving. Then humans came, and everything changed. Though you started few and helpless, soon your culture became the most influential on the planet. Then, just a few generations after your arrival, a miracle suddenly erupts out of the ground, this spirit guide you all revere."
"You mean the egg?" he said, brow furrowing.
"Exactly. Did you really think the timing accidental, or that your patrons had forgotten you?"
"Our patrons?" Lark frowned.
"You mean, you're implying the Rothen knew all along about the voyage of the tabernacle?" "Yes. Roken explained it to us this morning, and now everything makes sense. Even our own arrival on Jijo is no accident, dear Lark. Oh, our mission is partly to seek deserving pre-sapients to join our clan, but more than that, we came for you, because the experiment is finished."
"Experiment?" He felt an involuntary disorientation.
"An arduous trial for your small branch of humanity, cast away and forgotten, or so you thought, on a savage world. It sounds harsh, but the road of uplift is hard when a race is destined for the heights our patrons plan for us."
Lark's mind whirled. "You mean our ancestors were meant to sneak down to Jijo as part of an ordeal that's supposed to transform us somehow? The egg is part of some Rothen scheme?"
"Design," Ling corrected,
a kind of elation invading her voice.
"A grand design, Lark. A test which your folk passed brilliantly, I'm told, growing stronger, smarter, and more noble, even as this awful place tried to grind you down. And now the time has come to graft this successful offshoot back onto the main trunk, helping all of humanity to grow, thrive, and better face the challenges of a dangerous universe."
Her grin was joyful, exuberant.
"Oh, Lark, when I spoke to you last, I thought we might be taking a few human castaways with us when we go. But now, the news is pure and grand, Lark. Ships are coming. So many ships. It is time to bring you all back home."
Asks.
"Astonishment! This news bellows through our waxy cavities, driving out the egg's pattern resonance with acrid vapors of surprise. We cannot coalesce as asks, nor contemplate these tidings with any sense of unity. The worst rumors of recent months, spread by irredentist Urish chiefs and bitter gray queens, claim that humans might abandon Jijo, departing with their sky cousins, leaving the other five to fester and be damned.
Yet even that dark fantasy left one solace to the rest of us, one comfort, the egg. Now we are told, disbelieve it, but how, that the holy ovoid was never ours, only humans all along, its dual purpose to guide earthlings toward greatness, while at the same time soothing, domesticating we other five, taming the other septs in order to keep humans safe during their brief stay on Jijo. Now, this is topped by insulting kindness, as Roken says the egg will be left as a parting gift. Left as a token, a trifle, a gratuity for our pains. Left to shame us all. Pause, my rings, pause, in sure fairness. Stroke vapors across the wax drippings, remember? Did not Lester Campbell seem as dismayed as the rest of us? Did not the sages resolve to conceal this news, lest rumors do great harm? It is useless. Even now, eavesdropping citizens rush off, dispersing exaggerated versions of what they overheard, casting a poison up and down the chain of pilgrims, shattering the rhythms that had been uniting us. Yet from the majestic Rothen, we sense cheerful unawareness that anything is wrong. Is this what it means to be a god? To know not what harm you do. Ripples of infection spread along the twisty trail. The worship chant breaks apart, dissolving into many twelves of muttering individuals. Now, from my our highest peak, we perceive another disturbance propagating from the front of the procession. The two disruptions meet like waves on a storm-tossed lake, rolling through each other in a great spume of noise. "The way is blocked," a galloping messenger cries, hastening back with word. "A rope barrier bars the path with a banner upon it." No infidel desecration. Keep sky filth away. Jijo will not be mocked. This can only be the work of zealots. Frustration spins round our core. The fanatics chose a fine time to make their gesture. We sages must go see. Even Vubbin makes haste, and my basal segments labor to keep up. Roken strides with graceful ease, seeming unperturbed. And yet, my rings, is this variance we observe in Roken's aura? Through our rauk, we sense discrepancy between parts of his face. As if the Rothen's outward calm masks a canker of seething wrath. Can Rauk read so much from an alien form we just met this very day? Is it because I have one of the few older Rauk surviving from earlier days? Or do we notice this because Treyiki are tuned to perceive disunity of self? Ahead, the defiant banner. Above, perched on cliffs, shouting youths brandish foolish but brave weapons. Below, Fahundau with his booming voice calls to them, asking them to state their demands. Their reply? Echoing down canyons and steam fumaroles, a command that the aliens depart, never to return, or else suffer vengeance by the greatest force on Jijo. The zealots threaten the Rothen with the egg. But did not Roken just claim the great ovoid as his to command? Across the Rothen's visage flows what I interpret as cool amusement. He calls the zealot's bluff.
Shall we see who has the power to back up their claims? The star god asks. This night the egg and all Jijo will sing our truth.
Lester and Vubbin plead for restraint, but Roken ignores them. Still smiling, he commands robots to each side of the gorge to seize the anchor bolts holding the barrier in place. Overhead, the rebel leader stretches her long neck, keening a curse in Plains dialect, invoking the sacred power of Jijo to renew, to cleanse impudent dross with fire. The young zealot is a fine showman, stamping her hooves, foretelling awful punishments. Our more credulous rings find it possible for a moment to believe. To believe. To believe.
What is happening? What is happening? What impressions pour in now faster than wax can melt, then penetrate awareness ring after ring in a manner that makes all events equal in both timing and import? What is happening?
Twin lightning bolts outline many twelves of pilgrims, their shadows fleeing from white flame, crackling metal complains, shattered, unable to fly, a pair of tumbling cinders, after image of demolition, two junk piles smolder, more dross to collect and send to sea. With other eye patches, I glimpse horrified surprise on the face of Ron, the sky human. Surrounding Roken, a schism of variants, like a Traiki sundered between run ring that is jolly and a neighbor filled with wrath. And now, though surfeited with impressions, suddenly there is more. With eye patches on the opposite side, we are first to glimpse a fiery spike. A searing brightness climbs the western sky, rising from the glade of gathering. The ground beneath us trembles. Actual sound takes a while longer to arrive, battling upward through thin air to bring us a low groan like thunder. At last, the pace of events slows enough for our spinning vapors to keep up. Happenings occur in order, not disjointed, parallel. Review my rings. Did we perceive two robots destroyed, even as they tore down the zealot's barrier? Then, were we dazzled by some vast explosion behind us, toward the glade of gathering? What had been a pilgrimage of union dissolves into a mob. Small groups hurry downhill toward a dusty, moonlit pall, left by that brief flame. Humans hang close together for protection, clinging to their remaining Hoonish and Cowanish friends, while other Cowans and many Urs clatter by, aloof, scornful, even threatening in their manner. Roken no longer walks, but rides a cushioned plate between his two remaining robots, speaking urgently into a hand-held device, growing more agitated by the moment. His human servants seem in shock. The female, Ling, holds the arm of Lark, our young human biologist. Uthan offers a ride, and they climb aboard his broad gray back. All three vanish down the trail after Roken. Bravely, knife-bright insight proposes similarly to carry this pile of rings, this asks. Can I, we refuse? Already, Fuhundao totes Vubbin in his strong, scaly arms. The Hoon sage lugs the Gekek, so both might hurry downhill to see what has happened. By majority ballot, our rings choose to accept the offer. But after several duras of jouncing, Cowanish haste, there are calls for a recount. Somehow, we clamp down, managing to hang on to her horny shell, wishing we had walked. Time passes through a gelatin of suspense, teasing us with idle speculation. Darkness swallows wisdom. Glittering stars seem to taunt. Finally, at an overlooking bluff, we jostle with others for a view. Can you sense it, my rings? Unified now, in shock, I see a steaming crater filled with twisted metal. The sanctuary where Roken and the sky humans dwelled among us for weeks. Their buried outpost. Now a fiery ruin. Acting with hot-blooded decisiveness, Urja and Lester call for volunteers to leap into that smoky pit, reckless of their own lives, heroically attempting rescue. But how could anyone survive within the wrecked station? Can anyone be found alive? We all share the same thought, all members of the Six, all of my rings. Who can doubt the power of the egg, or the fury of a planet scorned?
The Stranger. Doors seem to open with every song he rediscovers, as if old melodies are keys to unlock whole swathes of time. The earlier the memory, the more firmly it seems attached to a musical phrase or snippet of lyrics. Nursery rhymes especially take him swiftly down lanes of reclaimed childhood. He can picture his mother now, singing to him in the safety of a warm room, lying sweetly with ballads about a world filled with justice and love. Sweet lies that helped fix his temperament, even when he later learned the truth about a bitter, deadly universe. A string of whimsical ditties brings back to mind the bearded twins, two brothers who for many years shared the father role in his family web, a pair of incurable jokers who routinely set all six of the young web sibs giggling uncontrollably at their quips and good-natured antics. Reciting some of the simplest verses over and over, he finds he can almost comprehend the crude punchlines. A real breakthrough. He knows the humor is puerile, infantile. Yet he laughs and laughs at the old gag songs until tears stream down his cheeks. Ariana Fu plays more records for him, and several release floods of excitement as he relives the operettas and musical plays he used to love in late adolescence. A human art form, to help ease the strain as he struggled along with millions of other earnest young men and women, to grasp some of the lofty science of a civilization older than most of the brightest stars. He felt poignant pain in recovering much of what he once had been. Most words and facts remain alien, unobtainable. Even his mother's name, or his own, for that matter. But at least he begins to feel like a living being, a person with a past, a man whose actions once had meaning to others, someone who had been loved. Nor is music the only key. Paper offers several more. When the mood strikes, he snatches up a pencil and sketches with mad abandon, using up page after page, compelled to draw, even though he knows each sheet must cost these impoverished folk dearly. When he spies Pretty doodling away, graphing a simple linear equation, he delightedly finds that he understands. Math was never his favorite language, but now he discovers a new love for it. Apparently, numbers hadn't quite deserted him the way speech had. There is one more communion that he realizes while being treated by Pizora, the squishy pile of donut rings that used to frighten him so. It is a strange rapport, as foreign to words as day is to night. Robbed of speech, he seems better attuned to notice Pizora's nuances of smell and touch. Tickling shimmers course his body, triggered by the healer's ever-changing vapors. Again his hands seem to flutter of their own accord, answering Pizora's scent queries on a level he can only dimly perceive. One does not need words to notice irony. Being shaped much like this one had been his deadly foes, this he knew without recalling how. They were enemies to all his kind. How strange, then, that he should owe so much to a gentle pile of farting rings. All these tricks and surprises offer slim rays of hope through his desolation. But it is music that seems the best route back to whoever he once was. When Ariana Fu offers him a choice of instruments laid out in a glass case, he selects one that seems simple enough to experiment with, to use fishing for more melodies, more keys to unlock doors. His first awkward efforts to play the chosen instrument send clashing noises down the twisty aisles of his strange temple of books, hidden beneath a cave of stone. He strives diligently and manages to unloose more recollections of childhood, but soon discovers that more recent memories are harder to shake free. Perhaps in later life he had less time to learn new songs, so there were fewer to associate with recent events. Events leading to a fiery crash into that horrid swamp. The memories are there, he knows. They still swarm through his dreams as they once thronged his delirium. Impressions of vast vacuum vistas, of vital missions left undone, of comrades he feels shamed to have forgotten. Bent over the instrument with its 46 strings, he hammers away, one and two notes at a time, seeking some cue, some tune or phrase that might break the jam up in his mind. The more it eludes him, the more certain he grows that it is there. He begins to suspect it is no human song he seeks, but something quite different, something both familiar and forever strange. That night, he dreams several times about water. It seems natural enough, since Sarah had made it clear they would be departing on the steamboat tomorrow, leaving behind the great hall of paper books, heading for the mountain where the starship landed. Another ship voyage might explain the vague, watery images. Later, he knew better. Part 21. The Book of the Sea. In traveling the downward path, that of redemption, be not unaware of what you seek. To divorce your racial destiny from your former clan, from your associations, from the patrons who first gave your species speech and reason and starflight. You are saying that they failed the first time, that someone else should have a new chance to adopt your kind and try again. There is nobility in this gamble, nobility and courage. But do not expect gratitude from those you have spurned. The Scroll of Exile. Alvin's Tale.
The day came. After all our fantasies, preparations, and endless details,
There we were at last, the four of us standing by the open hatch of Wu Fan's dream.
"Shoulda built a raft instead,"
Huck muttered nervously, while static from her nearest wheel hub made my leg hair stand out.
"There's lots of rivers we could have explored all summer, all by ourselves. Done some nice, quiet fishing, too."
I was hyperventilating my throat sacs, as if packing their livid tissues with pure oxygen would help much where we were going. Fortunately, Tiug had provided each of us with mild relaxant drugs, which might explain Urran's easy composure.
"I couldn't have gone on a raft,"
Urran replied in flat, deadpan tones.
"I'd have gotten wet."
We all turned to stare at her, then each of us in our own way burst out laughing. Pincer whistled, Huck guffawed, and I umbled till it hurt. Oh, Urran, what a character.
"You're right," added Pincer Tip. "The hot air balloon would have been a much better plan. Let's talk Uriel into doing a retrofit.
"I shop you two,"
Huck chided a little unfairly, since she had started it. We all turned as Uriel approached, Tiug following two paces behind. The Traiki's little partial, Ziz, now recovered from its distending ordeal, lay back in its assigned cage under the dream's bubble window.
"You have your charts?"
Uriel inspected Pincer's pouch to make sure. Made of laminated plastic by a human-invented process, the sheets were tough, durable, and therefore somewhat less than legal. But we were heading for the midden anyway, so wasn't it all right? We had studied the course chosen by Uriel to follow as soon as the dream's wheels touched the muddy bottom.
"Compass?"
Both Pincer and Urran were equipped. Huck's magnetically driven axles shouldn't interfere much if she didn't get too excited.
"We've gone over contingency tactics and rehearsed as much as possible, given our haste, I hope."
Uriel shook her head in the manner of a human expressing regret.
"There's just one thing left to cover, an object you are to seek out while down there. A thing I need you to find."
Huck craned an eye stalk around to semaphore me. "See, I told you so," she flashed in visual gal too. Huck had maintained for days that there must be some item Uriel desperately wanted, an ulterior motive for all this support, something we alone with our amateur bathy were qualified to find. I ignored her smug boast. The problem with Huck is that she's right just often enough to let her think it's a law of nature.
"This is what you're looking for,"
Uriel said, lifting up a sketch pad so that no one but we four could see, showing a spiky shape with six points, like a piece in a child's game of jacks. Tendrils or long cables stretched outward from two of the arms, trailing in opposite directions off the page. I wondered if it might be some kind of living thing.
"It is an artifact we need rather urgently,"
Uriel went on.
"Even more important than the artifact, however, is the strand of wire running away from it. It is this strand that you seek,
that you shall seize and fasten with the retrieval cord so that we can haul it back.
Sheesh, I thought. The four of us were modernist gloss junkies who would gladly raid the midden for treasure, even in defiance of the scrolls. But now, to have a sage order us to do that very thing? No wonder she preferred not letting nearby citizens in on this heresy.
"Will do,"
Pincer exclaimed, briefly teetering on two legs in order to salute with three. As for the rest of us, we already stood on the ramp. What were we going to do? Use this as an excuse to back out? All right, I considered it. So strap me to the egg and sing till I confess. I was the last one aboard, unless you count Hufu, who scampered through my legs as I was about to dog the hatch. I tightened the wheel, and the skink bladder seals spread thin, oozing like immunity chalk between a Treyiki's member rings. The closing shut us off from nearly all sound, except the hissing, gurgling, rumbling, and sighing of four frightened kids just coming to realize what a fix all their hummocking daydreams had gotten them into. It took about half a Majura to make certain the air system and dehumidifiers worked. Pincer and Urron went over a checklist up front, and Huck tested her steering bars, while I squatted in the very back with nothing to do but stroke the crank that I would use whenever the dream needed the services of an engine. To pass the time, I umbled Hufu, whose claws were a welcome distraction, scratching a nervous itch that tickled the outer surface of my heart spine. "If we die, please let Uriel at least drag our bodies home," I thought. And maybe it was a prayer, like humans often do in tight spots, according to books I've read. "Let my folks have a life bone for voofening, to help them in their grief and disappointment over how I misspent the investment of their love."
Part 22. The Book of the Slope. Legends. Anyone who travels by riverboat and listens to the compelling basso of a Hoonish helmsman knows something of the process that once made them starfaring beings. For one thing, the sound is clearly where their race name comes from. According to legend, the Gutatsa patrons, who originally adopted and uplifted pre-sapient Hoon, were entranced by the musical trait. While splicing in speech, reason, and other niceties, the Gutatsa also worked to enhance the penetrating, vibrant output of the Hoonish throat sac, so that it might enrich their clients' adulthood when they took up mature responsibilities in galactic society. It would, the Gutatsa predicted, help make the Hoon better patrons when their turn came to pass on the gift of wisdom, continuing the billion-year-old cycle of intellect in the five galaxies. Today, we know our Hoonish neighbors as patient, decent folk, slow to anger, though doughty in a fix. It is hard to reconcile this image with the reaction of Urish and later human settlers on first learning that the Tall Ones dwelled on Jijo, a response of animosity and fear. Whatever the initial reasons for that loathing, it soon ebbed, then vanished within a single generation. Whatever quarrels divided our star god ancestors, we on Jijo do not share them. These days, it is hard to find anyone among the six who can claim not to like the Hoon. Yet there remains a mystery. Why do they dwell on Jijo at all? Unlike other races of the six, They tell no tale of persecution or even of a quest for breeding space. When asked why their sneak ship defied great odds to seek this hidden refuge, they shrug and cannot answer. A sole clue lies in the Scroll of Redemption, where we read of an inquiry by the last Glaver sage, who asked a first-generation Hoonish settler why his folk came, and got this deeply humbled answer.
To this cached haven we came, in hope seeking, on a heartfelt quest to recover the lamented spines of lost youth. Here we were sent on the advice of wise secret oracles, nor was the danger-ridden trip in vain, for behold what in delighted surprise we already have won.
At that point, the Hoon colonist was said to point at a crude raft fashioned from boo logs and sealed with tree sap, earliest precursor of all the vessels to follow, plying Jijo's rivers and seas. From our perspective, 1,000 years later, it is hard to interpret the meaning of it all. Can any of us today imagine our shaggy friends without boats? If we try to picture them cruising space in starships, do we not envision those, too, running before storm and tide, sluicing their way between planets by keel, rudder, and sail? By that logic, does it not follow that Urs once galloped across galactic prairies with stellar winds blowing their waving tails? Or that any starcraft fashioned by humans ought to resemble a tree? From a reappraisal of Jijoan folklore by Erkintawan and Herman Chang Jones, Tarik City Printers, Year of Exile, 1901. Dwur. It was a Midura past nightfall when the ember crossed the sky, a flicker that grew briefly as it streaked by, crossing the heavens to descend southeast. Dwur knew it was no meteor because the spark traveled below the clouds. Only after it was gone, dropping beyond the next rank of forested knolls, did he hear a low, muttering purr, barely above the rustling of the tree branches. Dwur might never have noticed if his dinner had agreed with him, but his bowels had been shaky ever since the 4 humans began supplementing their meager supplies with foraged foods. So he sat at the makeshift latrine, in a cleft between 2 hills, waiting for his innards to decide whether to accept or reject his hard-won evening meal. The others were no better off. Danil and Jennin never complained, but Lena blamed Dwur while her intestines growled.
"Some mighty hunter. You've been over the pass dozens of times and can't tell what's poison from what's not?"
"Please, Lena," Jennin had asked. "You know Dwur never crossed the Venom Plane. All he can do is look for stuff that's like what he knows."
Danil tried his hand at peacemaking.
"Normally we'd eat the donkeys as their packs lightened, but they're weak after recent stream crossings, and we can't spare any from carrying our extra gear."
He referred to the weight of books, tools, and special packages that were meant to make human life beyond the rimmers somewhat more than purely savage. If it was finally decided to stay here forever, Dwur still hoped it wouldn't come to that.
"One thing we do know," Danil went on, "humans can survive here in the Gray Hills,
and without all the VAT processes we're used to back home. Right now, we're adjusting to some local microbes, I'm sure. If the Sooner band got used to them, so can we.
Yes, Dwyer had thought. But survival doesn't mean comfort. If Reddy's any indication, these Sooners are a grumpy lot. Maybe we're getting a taste of how they got that way.
Things might improve once Dan'l set up vats of his own, growing some of the yeasty cultures that made many Jijoan foods palatable to humans. But there would be no substitutes for the Treiki refined enzymes that turned bitter ping fruit and bly yogurt into succulent treats. Above all, Dwyer and the other newcomers would count on the Sooners to explain which local foods to avoid.
Assuming they cooperate.
Reddy's relatives might not appreciate having the new order of life explained to them.
I wouldn't either in their position.
While Dan'l was skilled at negotiation and persuasion, Dwyer's role would be to back up the sage's words, giving them force of law. From Reddy's testimony, her tribe likely totaled no more than 40 adults. The social structure sounded like a typical macho stratified hunting band, a standard human devolution pattern that old Fallon long ago taught Dwyer to recognize, with a fluid male-ranking order enforced by bluster, personal intimidation, and violence. The preferred approach to ingathering such a group, worked out by Dwyer's predecessors, was to make contact swiftly and dazzle the Sooners with gifts before shock could turn into hostility, buying time to map the web of alliances and enmities within the band. After that, the procedure was to choose some promising middle-ranked males and help those candidates perform a coup, ousting the formerly dominant group of bully boys whose interest lay in keeping things as they were. The new leaders were then easy to persuade to come home. It was a time-tested technique used successfully by others faced with the task of retrieving wayward human clans. Ideally, it shouldn't prove necessary to kill anybody. Ideally. In truth, Dwyer hated this part of his job.
You knew it might come to this. Now you pay for all the freedom you've had.
If gentle suasion didn't work, the next step was to call in militia and hunt down every stray. The same hard price had been agreed to by every sept in the commons, as an alternative to war and damnation.
But this time things are different. This time we don't have any law on our side, except the law of survival.
Instead of bringing illegal settlers back to the slope, Ozawa planned to take over Reddy's band, guiding them toward a different way of life, but one still hidden from sight.
Only if the worst happens, if we're the last humans alive on Jijo.
Dwyer's mind reeled away from that awful notion, as his innards wrestled with the remnants of his meal.
If this keeps on, I'll be too weak to win a wrestling match, or however else Jass and Bomb settle their tribal ranking. It may come down to Lena and her tools, after all.
Throughout the journey, the stocky blonde woman carefully tended one donkey, carrying the gadgets of her personal hobby, a human technology passed down since the first ancestors landed on Jijo, one so brutal that it had been seldom used, even during the Urish Wars.
"My equalizers," Lena called the wax-sealed wooden crates, meaning their contents made her able to enforce Dan'l's verdicts as thoroughly as Dwyer's muscle and physical skill.
"It won't come to that," he vowed, commanding his body to shape up. Dwyer touched several fingertips whose frostbite damage might have been much worse.
"I've always been luckier than I deserved."
According to Sarah, who had read extensively about Earth's past, The same thing could be said about the whole bloody human race. That was when the glowing ember crossed the sky, streaking overhead while Dwyer sat at the makeshift latrine. He would have never noticed the sight had he been facing another way, or engaged in an activity more demanding of his attention. As it was, he stared glumly after the falling spark while the rumbling thunder of its passage chased up and down nearby canyons, muttering echoes in the night. They faced more stream crossings the next day. It was hard country, which must have influenced the Sooners' ancestors to come this way in the first place. Guarded first by the Venom Plain, then ravines and whitewater torrents,